Welcome everybody back to the Common Anomaly Podcast. I'm your host, Stuart James. Joining me again, Clayton James, for episode 8. How's it going, brother?
Good. Thanks for having me back again.
No problem. We've got two stories today. We're going to try out a bit of a different format. So you've prepared something. I've prepared something. Who's going to go first? Should we flip a coin? What are we going to do?
I mean, this was all your idea, so I think you should go first.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough. I'm, judging by your notebook, I'm massively underprepared. But that's all right. I'll go first. Sure. So today, I had quite a journey. So I'm going to be presenting this book, Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience, Radical New Techniques by Graham Nichols. So this is a book I've had in my library a long time. So we're in the middle of kind of shuffling the house around a little bit. So all my books were in storage, kind of in between rooms, basically for the entire time we've been doing this show. And I knew I had like a fair bit of paranormal books that I've collected over the years. So last weekend I went and I bought a bookshelf and I packed those boxes. So now I've got a nice little paranormal reference library going on, and I just decided to pluck a book off the shelf that looked interesting, and I dove into it this week. And it took me to some places I didn't quite expect. Because basically this is a guide. There's stories in here as well, but basically the author, Graham Nichols, is giving us tools to try and develop a practice for ourselves to induce out-of-body experiences, or astral travel is what some people call this. And so I thought, you know, I'll read the book and I'll try and experiment with some of these techniques myself this week. And it led me to some strange places. I didn't kind of get what I expected out of it, as maybe a little more than a bargain for, to be honest.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. But anyway, let's get into that. So just a quick bit about the author. Graham Nichols lives in London, England. He's had hundreds of out-of-body experiences. He's a world-recognized expert on the subject, experienced speaker on many areas of spirituality, art, psychical research, and he's presented his ideas at prestigious institutions such as the Science Museum of London, the London College of Spirituality, and Cambridge University. Hmm. So that's a bit about him. And so what I'd first like to do, I'm not, sorry for the noise of flipping pages. You're going to get a bit of that. Sorry, folks. I'm not going to read out tons from the book, but I do kind of want to just read the opening paragraph, because it gives you a good idea of what the book's about, where he's coming from, and the general sense of the experiences. So here's that. The author writes, "I've watched the sun's rays breaking through the Earth's upper atmosphere while contemplating the swirl of oceans around the continents of the world beneath me. I have drifted through the silent vastness of space, surrounded by endless stars and gaseous clouds of awe-inspiring beauty. I have seen the magnificence of the universe reflected in the structure of flowers, leaves, and stems as I look deep into their being with my non-physical eyes. I have experienced the profound nature of life, the interconnectedness of all that is around us. I have seen the wonders of the physical and the non-physical perception. I have stood at the threshold of life and death and explored the hinterlands of consciousness. And through all of these life-changing moments, I have been aware that anyone open enough to the possibility can have similar experiences themselves." So that grabbed me right away. I thought, this will be cool. This will be interesting, right? I'll dive into this. And yeah, so there's definitely just some simple techniques that he breaks down throughout the book. And one of them was starting a dream journal. So one of the interesting things that he lays out here that you see through the first few chapters of the book is that all psi phenomenon or psychical phenomenon is kind of interconnected. I would say that it's all one and the same thing. Remote viewing, astral travel, near-death experiences,
Lucid dreaming.
Lucid dreaming. They're all connected. They're all kind of the same phenomenon or different facets of the same phenomenon.
Okay.
And I thought this will be great. You know, I've had lucid dreams just randomly occur to me without any attempt at doing so. And I've also experimented with developing a practice of lucid dreaming and had quite a bit of success. And it seems like lucid dreaming in itself could be like the precursor, like that's level one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then OBEs, out-of-body experiences, are kind of level maybe three or four
mm-hmm.
once you kind of go past that. So I spent the week starting a dream journal. And to be honest, I've always been someone who kind of looks down on journaling. I don't like journaling. Oh, I'm going to write my journal, you know? And apologies to anyone who writes a journal. Really.
Way to alienate the audience.
No shade. But it's just not something I've ever done, you know? I'm not someone who likes to record everything. But I do see the utility in it, right? And I thought, you know, if this is something that's going to help, I can try it at least for a week, right? And see how it goes. So I started a dream journal. I started doing some meditation this week. And full disclosure, spoiler, I did not leave my body at any point this week. But what I discovered is that it was a much more emotional journey. And that's something deeper into the book Graham talks about, is that, you know, this isn't something you pick up, you read the book in a weekend, and then suddenly you're jumping out of your body on command. No, it's a practice, and it's a spiritual journey of kind of self-discovery you have to go through, and it's hard work. It's like you wouldn't do one push-up and then look in the mirror and go, why am I not, you know, shredded already, right? You wouldn't take one piano lesson and suddenly come out Beethoven, right? And this is much the same thing. It takes months, maybe years, to develop this skill to the point where you can actually maybe achieve that result of being able to step outside your body. So I didn't get there. I didn't even get to have a lucid dream. But what I did find was that I had a very introspective journey this week. And I feel like what I discovered, which is something he talks about in the book, that I've got certain barriers and maybe fears and apprehensions that are preventing me at the current moment from getting to the place where I could expand my consciousness to the point where I could leave my body. So I'm just going to throw this over to you, question. So have you had any experiences yourself in this realm of lucid dreaming or out-of-body experiences?
Well, it's a subject I became really interested in, actually, well, I guess back in high school. And I learned a lot about it reading books, just like the one you have there. Myself, I've not had what you'd call an out of body experience myself. You know, I'm someone that I remember my dreams a lot more than most. Like a lot [S2] Yep. [S1] Of people, they don't remember their dreams at all. And myself, I do, and I've had definitely experiences with sleep paralysis,
right.
Which you did the episode with I am on.
Yep.
I do have that occur, sporadically, maybe two or three times per year.
Yeah.
Lucid dreaming, and for any people that don't aren't familiar with that concept, that's when you're dreaming. You know, you never know you're dreaming.
Yeah.
When you're dreaming, you kind of just take everything as it is
at face value. Yeah.
And your mind is operating more on instinct than actual thought. A lucid dream is where you have a moment of clarity in your dream, and you realize that this is a dream.
Yeah.
And
you become aware that you're in a dream state.
And
without, normally what happens to people is they wake up.
Yeah.
Kind of the moment they figure out they're in a dream. So lucid dreaming, you're able to maintain it at least for a while. and explore the dream space, aware that you're inside of a dream.
Yeah, you're able to stay in that dream state, but that moment of clarity, what that kind of unlocks, it unlocks all of your other mental faculties, and you're able to, you know, think and make decisions outside of just operating on instinct and taking everything as it is in the dream.
Yeah.
And it's something that just happens randomly to people. It's happened to me once or twice. Never lasted.
Just by accident?
Yeah.
Yep.
Never lasted
have you ever, very long. Have you ever tried to develop a practice? Have you ever tried any of the techniques to get to a lucid dream?
No, I haven't. I didn't even really discover there was a name for such a thing until much later.
Yeah, and actually, lucid dreaming is now a confirmed phenomenon, and it exists within the realm of science. But it wasn't always that way. I think as early as the 1990s, it was still considered to not exist. You know, it was pseudoscience.
Yeah, I mean, a person would claim, "Oh, this crazy thing happened to me while I was dreaming," and you know, the reaction most would have would be like, well, you were just dreaming.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think so many people go through their waking life not really in full awareness that the very idea that you could be fully aware in a dream is maybe so foreign, you know?
And you speak to a practice of you know, doing this intentionally, lucid dreaming. I believe one of the most common practices there is to make a habit of, in your everyday life, just pausing for a moment what you're doing and retracing your steps. What am I doing right now? Well, I'm recording a podcast. What happened before that? Well, I was walking from my apartment to your house to record a podcast. What was I doing before that? Oh, I was hurriedly scribbling some notes together for the podcast.
Yeah.
Just retrace your steps and get into the habit of doing that, and you'll eventually start doing it automatically to the point where you're even doing it in your dreams. And when that sequence of events becomes incongruent, when you say, well, what am I doing now? I'm doing this. Well, what happened before that? I don't remember. How did I get here?
Oh, right. I lied down in my bed and I was going to sleep.
And then that's when you have that moment of clarity where, oh my God, this is a dream. I'm not really here.
That actually reminds me. So maybe this is a good moment to kind of introduce the audience to what I was doing to try and induce a lucid dream or an OBE. I was open to both. So I tried two main techniques. Actually, neither of those things were in this book. They're things I picked up from other sources. I'll just say I can't remember exactly which one. It was years ago when I first developed a lucid dreaming practice, and one is I just saw the other day in a podcast. And it's a trick where your mind doesn't like, I guess psychologically, your brain doesn't like unresolved business, right?
Okay.
So this trick I learned is you sit down with your dream journal and you write a sentence you're not going to finish, right? Mm. So you write down, tonight I realized I was lucid dreaming when ... and then you put the journal away.
Okay.
Right? And there's been studies on this, like waiters have phenomenal memory for their orders.
Some of them.
let's say in general. An experienced or practiced excellent waiter or waitress has a really good memory for orders up until the point they've paid the bill. And then the brain kind of dumps that information.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if you're preparing in school for a test. Right? And you take the test, you do really well, and then say your teacher surprises you the very next day by making you retake the test you just took yesterday. You'll probably do about 10% worse.
Yeah.
Because your brain has said, you're keeping that in a file because it has a purpose, right? And when that purpose is resolved, you dump it, right?
It's in the RAM, but it hasn't been written to the hard drive.
That's right. Exactly, right? So the idea is to create something unresolved for your brain to keep in that RAM, mm-hmm. right? So that when you go to sleep, your brain is still trying to work out what that second half of that sentence is that you've left unresolved.
That's interesting.
Right? I thought that was really cool. And then the other technique was just to spend a couple minutes before you go to bed, right before you put your head down, fall asleep, and look at your hands and to really examine your hands. Flip them over, look at them, and kind of say to yourself mentally or aloud, you know, these are my hands. And when I see my hands in my dream, I'm going to realize I'm dreaming and I'm not going to wake up. And you just kind of repeat that affirmation or something similar that works for you until you feel like that's fully absorbed. That intention is kind of placed in your mind and then you go to bed. And that's actually the technique I found the most success with the last time years ago when I started a practice. And the thinking behind that is, you know, your hands are your interface for the world, but you don't really kind of consciously acknowledge them very often because they're just such a point of interface that you don't think about. You don't think about how you move your hands constantly. You just do, right?
Yeah, you know, they call them fingers, but I never see them fing. Oh, wait, there they go.
There they go. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it, right? And so basically you're just trying to create, I don't know what you call it, a switch in your brain where you'll have enough of a, oh, wait a minute, uh-huh, right? Mm-hmm. And that'll trigger you into the lucid state of being okay. aware. So it didn't work. At least not so far. You know, it's only been a week. That's probably not long enough. I think I was working at it at least kind of a month before it really started working for me last time. So I think I've got to stick with it just a little while longer and give it a chance.
Are you going to?
I am. I am. Yes. I'm going to keep on with it because, yeah, actually, okay, there was some interesting things that did pop up out of this experience this week, but I don't want to go there just yet. I see our audio is doing that funky thing again where our left and right of our stereo seems to be out of phase. Do we want to pause or do we just want to keep going and hope it's okay?
I mean,
we're this far into it already.
You're the audio guy.
You know, I don't know. It's really weird. But I've seen it before, and when we listen to it after, it's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, I think we're okay.
So let's just keep going. Sorry, audience. We're just trying to work out a technical thing here. But yeah, we're going to keep going and assume this is all going to be fine. We'll see at the end. Okay, so the other concept I want to dig into this book that Graham really talks about is extended mind theory. And so this is kind of popularized by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who's another researcher, biologist and psi researcher based in London in the same vein. He's authored more than 80 scientific papers, 10 books, research fellow at the Royal Society, studied natural sciences at Cambridge, yada, yada, yada. Smart dude. And so he's popularized.
It's popular.
The more I say it, the more I can't say it. Morphic fields. So are you familiar with this idea of morphic fields and Rupert Sheldrake?
No, I'm not.
So it's basically the idea, and Graham Nichols in the book kind of subscribes to this, calling the out-of-body experience basically a misnomer. You're not really detaching from your body. You're entering an expanded state of consciousness. So you're not... It's not like your spirit jumping away from your body and it's no longer connected, but you're expanding your awareness and your consciousness beyond the confines of your body, but you always remain connected.
This is so good. This really ties into what I want to talk about later.
Excellent. So. Excellent. Yeah. Did you want to hit a point?
No. It won't make sense now, but okay. we'll get to it.
Okay. All right. So I'll just expand on this a little bit. So morphic fields are, and there's actually some legitimate science to back this up. You know, your body has an electric field, mm-hmm. electromagnetic field generated by the pumping of your heart, you know, creates an electrical field around your body that is measurable by instruments as far as 6 feet outside your physical body.
Right? Okay.
So we're both using the same microphone. We're leaning in. So it's like you're inside my electromagnetic field and you're inside mine, and we're impacting each other's magnetic fields. And the idea is that all living things create some level of this field around your body, this energetic electrical field that is impacted by your thoughts, intentions, and ideas.
Okay.
And this is how we're able to engage in psi phenomenon, how people are able to read each other's minds in some cases, and how we're able to expand our awareness to go to other places where we're not physically residing, and remote view,
yeah,
or gain access to other events in time and space.
And there's a lot to that. Sorry to interrupt.
No, go for it.
With remote viewing, you know, that's it's taken seriously by science to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Like the U.S. military actually had a program where they were trying to train people to,
in the Cold War, yeah.
Yeah, to
Russia
remote
as well.
View and basically create a division of psychic spies.
Yep. Yeah, it was a real thing. I forget what the name of the program was called off the top of my head.
It was called...
But there's a famous movie. I think it was
The Men Who Stare at Goats. Yeah.
George Clooney.
Yeah.
All about that. Yeah. Really funny film.
I think it was called the Stargate Project, not to be confused with the current Stargate Project.
Which is all about
AI infrastructure, but it was
I
believe it was also called Project Stargate.
That's right, yeah. And the Russians did the same thing. Actually, I think the CIA felt like they had to develop their own program because they're so far behind what Russian scientists were accomplishing in this mm-hmm. field. And yeah, it was basically psychic espionage. But yeah, it's widely acknowledged, and there's a lot of veridical evidence. That could be a whole episode of its own. At some point, we'll have to do that.
Yeah.
Because that's really fascinating stuff. I've tried some stuff. There's actually some fun apps, just like iPhone apps you can download where you can practice remote viewing.
Okay.
I'll show you one after the show. They're really cool. But anyway, so that's this idea. And so Graham, he asserts something that I don't necessarily agree with in this book at one point, which I want to go into, where, you know, he's done a ton of work on this himself. He's had hundreds of out-of-body experiences himself, and he says, you know, you can't really have a negative experience. No harm can come to you, because that's something that's talked about in the book. You know, is there any risks here, right? Because that's where some of the fear comes from. Like, I'm afraid to leave my body because what if I can't get back in? What if I die? What if I'm stuck outside my body? Or what if I encounter, you know, on the astral plane, a sinister entity of some kind that wants to take over my body?
Yeah, what if you leave and
Somebody else jumps in?
Something
yeah.
else takes your spot.
Yeah, and that's called a walk-in, right? So there's stories around that as well. And so I kind of read that, and I was like, I'm not sure I agree with that, because that kind of doesn't jive with other accounts I've heard. A couple weeks back on the episode I was on, we talked about the research of Rosemary Ellen Guiley,
mm-hmm.
who asserted very much the opposite, that when you're in this state, even in the dream state, she views as something your consciousness has left your body, and you're inherently somewhat vulnerable in that state.
Mm-hmm.
And malevolent entities will capitalize on that opportunity to harass you and try and harm you. And so what I think, my view on this is, you know, I think Graham is doing this under very kind of controlled circumstances, where he's intentionally going into these altered states. And I think definitely the intention behind what you're doing, you know, if you're going into an experience, intentionally inducing the experience yourself with the intention of it being very controlled, you probably will have more positive experiences than not.
Yeah.
Because you're very much in control of what's happening. But some people just fall into these altered states purely by accident, or perhaps they've ingested hallucinogens or other drugs that have pushed them into these states. Graham Hancock tells a story about having an out-of-body experience where I think he had had a house party when he was a teenager, and he accidentally, electrocuted himself. And he was kicked out of his body. Like, if you imagine, you know, what's the Marvel movie? Doctor Strange.
Oh, yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Where he, you know, he gets pushed outside of his yeah. body. It was just like that. You know, he electrocuted himself on a kitchen appliance. Like, mm-hmm. he was hung over the next morning after a party trying to plug in a blender or something and electrocuted himself. And he got thrown across the room, you know? And he realized that he, you know, his body was on the floor on the other side of the kitchen, and he was floating outside of his body on mm-hmm. the opposite end of the kitchen, looking at himself, but was able to, you know, just go float over and get himself back inside his body, and he didn't die.
Graham Hancock, that name sounds so familiar, but I can't place it. Was he on, like, Ancient Aliens or something?
He has been, yeah. He's been okay. on Rogan. He's done a lot of stuff on... ancient civilizations. Graham Hancock's big things is he thinks we're a species with amnesia, is the famous thing he says. So he thinks we have a forgotten history where we were much farther advanced in ancient history.
This also ties in so well to what I have yeah. here. So
yeah.
We'll talk more later.
But anyway, since we're a little bit on a Graham Hancock tangent, one thing he says that I really gravitate to when we look at psi phenomenon, because there is a stigma in our society. And one thing I saw him express, I think it was when he was on Joe Rogan, is that we don't, in our current society, we don't value these altered states. We very much place all our value on the high reason, rational state of consciousness, right? And with good mm-hmm. reason. And what he says is you don't want the pilot operating the plane you're sitting on to be in an altered state. You want them to be in that state of awareness and pure rationality to operate the plane effectively,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You don't want them exiting their body and going on a cosmic journey mm-hmm. when they're supposed to be flying the plane you're on, right? So there's good reason for that, but that doesn't mean that these states of mind have no utility. We just don't attribute any value to them in today's world.
Like there's no room for them in like the very mechanized world we have today.
That's right. Everything's very materialistic mm-hmm. is what I'd say, right? And so I think we've kind of neglected the spiritual side of ourselves. And I'm someone who's always thought, and maybe that's why I'm someone doing a show like this, is that there is more than what the kind of tools we have in these meat bags to perceive the world. There's more world out there than what we're able to experience with just our physical selves. So that's why I like exploring these kind of things. You know, I imagine people I know listening to this must think I'm like super woo and out there now. They're like, I had no idea Stuart was so kind of off the rails. But I'm not. I'm a very rational person.
I'd say so.
In my regular life. I feel like I'm very grounded. I don't know. Maybe you perceive me differently. But I don't feel like I'm that out there. But I'm a curious person.
You're probably more grounded than me.
Yeah. I just think I'm a curious person and I'm open-minded. And why would you limit yourself? I always think it must be so boring for, let's label them normies or NPCs. Sorry, no shade to anyone.
Muggles.
Yeah. But people out there that don't think about these, that aren't curious about these things, you know. And I always think, why would you limit yourself? Why would you shrink your world by so much, you know, that to think that there's just this and just the ins and outs of your daily grind. I think, at this point, I'll speak about this. So going through this process this week, I was doing the meditating, I was doing the dream journaling, And while I didn't have any ecstatic experiences or anything like that, I didn't leave my body, I found I did end up in a very introspective state. And I actually got very depressed getting up, getting in my car in the cold, spending an hour in traffic, going to work. Like, I very much felt the hamster wheel of my life the past week, you know?
You know, I think I had a similar week. I feel like
I feel like that's most weeks.
I feel like I had a week of Mondays this week.
Yeah, but I think just the practice of doing this stuff this week made me kind of hyper aware of that, of the daily grind. And it felt, you know, a little empty, and it left me feeling a little depressed and kind of despondent. But I will say that I felt like, and I, like, it was a stressful week at work. There was certain stuff going on. There was a lot of pressure and stress. But I felt like through being on the hamster wheel, even though I felt like my mind doesn't want to be here, you know, I feel like this is not what I want to be doing with my life necessarily, or my time today. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was more able to bring kind of my best self to those stressful situations and remain kind of calm and collected and centered in my own self, mm-hmm. to face those challenges. And I everything went really well, and I was able to deliver on what I needed to deliver to and navigate through challenging circumstances. So that's a positive. I feel like that was a positive benefit. But there was a bit of depression and just feeling like, you know, I'm in my 40s. I've been with the organization I'm with for almost 17 years now. So there's a certain degree of burnout and just repetition of, you know, being a wage slave. You know, can you? I know you can relate to that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not in my 40s yet.
You're right there, though.
I can see 40. I can see 40.
Right around the corner.
Very clearly from where I'm at.
40's and, knocking on the door.
And, you know, I've been, yeah, at the company I work for almost 13 years now. So not quite as long as you, but I'm getting there. And, yeah, approaching my 40s. And, maybe this is what's called a midlife crisis. I'm starting to feel like I've wasted so much time. But what you were saying there, it reminds me, just randomly reminded me of something Freud would talk about. Hmm. He was talking about how modern society is so anxious.
Right.
Because, you know, in older times, you know, when we were hunter-gatherer folk, you know, we had a lot of very specific existential fears. You know, we used to be afraid of the weather. We'd be afraid of the rain and the snow. We'd be afraid we'd go out and some predator would eat us.
Yeah.
You know, we feared the rain, so we invented roofs.
Right. Or we just didn't want to be wet.
We feared you know, other creatures on the planet. So we basically enslaved them. We feared death, so we invented religion. There's a lot fewer specific existential fears these days, but kind of the unintended side effect of that is we all just have a very vague anxiety in our lives. Sorry, bit of a tangent, but...
No, it's very...
What you were saying just reminded me of that quote from Freud.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's... Yeah, I don't know if it's an... It's not an existential threat, but it's kind of almost just a dread of nothingness, you know, or of meaninglessness, if that's a word. But, you know, I think that's kind of a hell into itself, is if you accept the idea that our lives are meaningless and you're basically all you have to look forward to is getting up and going to work and working for somebody else and waiting until you die, you know, that's not a fulfilling existence, right? And that's an existential crisis in itself. So that's what and no shade to normies, if that's your bag, you know, don't take that as a pejorative. But I'm just going to refer to you as normies. But yeah, I feel like the world is much more interesting where I live, right? Where there is mystery and there's wonder and there's these other facets of our existence to be explored.
I agree.
But anyway, that's a tangent. But anyway, where did I want to go from here?
Well, I have a question.
Shoot.
If you could have one of these experiences, you know, if you keep with your practice,
right,
and you eventually have an out of body experience, where would you go?
Where would I go? That's a good question. I mean,
I know where I'd go.
Oh, okay. Well, where would you go?
I'd go to Mars.
Mars? Yeah, that would be on the list for sure. I mean, probably, I'd probably go all over the solar system. You know, but yeah, and you know, I've not traveled much in my life. I've been a few places, but there's a lot I haven't seen in the world. So yeah, I definitely explore our planet and explore the other planets. But that's just on this physical plane. What I'm sure is maybe a few more rungs up the ladder, levels in the game, is that once you achieve this state, there's probably a certain point where you're able to access other levels of existence.
The astral plane.
Yeah. I'm sure the next step would probably be to try to connect with that. But yeah, I think it would be initially it would be more about just trying to absorb the realization that I am not my body, you know, that my consciousness, my awareness, my soul, if you will, is something more than this bag of meat in front of you kind of thing. Because I think just that realization in itself could be transformative into...
Yeah, it's something you'd have to ease into. Kind of like with VR, you know, the first time I tried out a VR headset, you know, I was only able to have the thing on for maybe 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I think I've had enough of this.
That's a lot, yeah.
I've had enough of this.
But then with repeated use, you get used to it. You get more comfortable being in that immersed state. And actually, one of the things Graham Nichols talks about is both sensory deprivation, and I very much wanted to hit this note, so thank you, and sensory immersion. Mm-hmm. So one of the techniques that's used to achieve these altered mental states where you can experience an OBE is sensory deprivation. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with that. There's like tanks you can go into, float tanks, you know, where it's high level of salt water, so you're very buoyant, and you wear goggles and it's all dark, and they maybe put on whale noises or whatever so you can relax. But depriving your senses of as much stimulus as possible can help push you into this state, because then all you have is basically your internal thoughts. It's a way of inducing kind of meditation.
Yeah.
And a different brainwave state. But also immersion, that the antithesis of that, right? And he puts the example of churches. Like if you think about Gothic cathedrals and temples,
yeah,
they're very much constructed to alter your experience, to help you connect to God, right? Would be the objective. But it's basically creating the ideal environment to which you can do this. And he's actually, I think one of the art installations he did back in the early 2000s was a VR experience, but instead of an ornate kind of elaborate temple, it was barren empty spaces, if you think about the Matrix loading room where it's just all white around you, right? And using that kind of stimulus to create immersion or deprivation to change your perceptive inputs. And I thought that was really curious, you know. And if you think about like a sweat lodge, right, we always use kind of tools and stimulus to alter our state of consciousness, right? You turn the heat up in a sauna, you smoke some tobacco, and you get really sweaty, and then you get a drum beat going. It changes your brain waves, so we use immersive stimulus as well as deprivation to kind of create the opportunities for these experiences to happen.
I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Interesting, right?
Yeah.
One of the things he also suggests is he talks about, you know, exercise and, you know, practices and getting enough sleep. And one thing I really disagreed with him is he recommends a vegetarian or vegan diet. So I don't agree with that. Just say that right now. I did not give up meat this week. And, you know, I'm not sure. I'm a vegetarian. You know, I don't have a problem with anybody having that, making that life choice for themselves.
No, absolutely.
And he goes into all the kind of what I would call kind of modern holier-than-thou arguments of why it's good to be a vegetarian or a vegan. I mean, he points out, and he's not wrong, that, you know, in other spiritual practices throughout time, they'll have used that technique and will subscribe to a vegan diet for spiritual purity, I don't know, whatever. But I personally, I don't think that's true. I think there's definitely our modern world, kind of modern monoculture and farming and how we treat animals within our food production system is not great.
It's not good.
There's a lot of problems there. But from a level of, you know, small family farms and responsible animal husbandry, you know, I don't have any problems with eating meat. And I don't, like, our bodies are designed to absorb that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reason, it's the reason why we have brains big enough to even write books and have these conversations. So,
yeah, brains are expensive.
Yeah, and they need the fuel, right? And we have, like, 6 different organs devoted to, you know, absorbing animal fat, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
That's the nature of life. And, you know, the way I look at it, I've always been a fan of panpsychism. So I think, you know, the plant is no lower a life form than the animal in that regard. You know, all living things have to absorb other living things to perpetuate themselves. You're just making a value distinction between, you know, our fellow animals and plants, right? But lettuce screams when you eat it.
True story. I was just reminded of a quote from The Simpsons. Well, I'm a level 5 vegan. I won't eat anything that casts a shadow.
Or a breatharian. Isn't that one where it's like you just derive nutrition from the air? Isn't that one?
I don't know if that's possible. There are certainly people out there that claim that's possible.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that's been independently verified.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they die. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so I think I'm just about ready to wrap this up. Okay. The one anecdote I will tell. Okay. So I've been, like I said, I didn't leave my body. I didn't even have a lucid dream. But I have been keeping the dream journal. And just yesterday, when I was supposed to be kind of finishing preparing for this show, I thought, you know, I had had a really rough week. I was kind of down, but I had yesterday off. And so I'm going to devote my time yesterday to getting my head right, getting out of this funk I'm in, refocusing on the subject matter for the show, meditating. And so I was doing all those things, and then mid-afternoon, before I even got to looking at this book again and refreshing my memory and finishing my research, I was called downstairs. I was doing laundry, and all the drains were backing up, the shower and the toilet and the sink and in Bridget's bathroom downstairs.
Uh-oh.
Were all backing up with gray water and flooding the basement. So we shut off the laundry, and, you know, I spent the rest of the afternoon and evening, you know, snaking drains and bailing out water, you know, out into the backyard.
Oh, dear.
Because nothing would drain. We tried calling a plumber. Plumber said call the city. on the city. Didn't get here until about like 9:45 at night, because it was a clog in our mainline drain.
Oh, okay.
So it was kind of between the house and the right.
Yeah.
So but they were great. They were in and out in like 20 minutes and fixed it, and we're all good now. But so that was an ordeal that took up a lot of time during the day, and then it was all done. 10:30 at night, I thought, oh great, I can finally relax. And it dawned on me, wait a minute, my dream journal. And I went back to my dream journal, and the night before, I had dreamt that something was going outside, and the whole neighborhood was flooding and filling
Oh,
up to the property line.
interesting.
Right? And then even there was a weird detail of having to wear like a living snake as a belt or something like that.
Snaking
And I was
drains.
snaking, yeah, right? And I was like, holy shit, did I dream the future?
Maybe.
Have you ever had a precognitive dream?
You know, they're
Didn't you dream lottery numbers one time?
I did.
I remember one time you being super bummed.
I did. This was way back where I had a dream that I had won the lottery. And I very specifically remembered the lottery numbers I had picked in my dream. I very specifically remembered it. And
Yeah, and you don't typically remember numbers and things like that from
and
dreams.
I actually when like the next day oh, what was that? What was that? I remember these numbers really specifically, so I wrote them down. And I didn't actually go out and buy a lottery ticket. I didn't. I was like, oh, it's just a dream. I was all excited about it at first, but then, as I got my day going, I became less and less enthusiastic about it.
And you probably
And
forgot about it because your day takes over.
I completely forgot about it. And then, either later that night or the next day, I was just randomly remembered this, and I'm like, oh yeah, I never went out and bought lottery numbers. I wonder what the winning numbers were. I wonder what the winning numbers were, because there was a lottery draw the night before.
And they were in your numbers.
And my numbers won,
Man.
and I didn't buy the damn ticket.
That must have been a hard blow.
Yeah,
That must have been really
I was
awful.
pretty devastated.
Yeah, it's like your whole life course could have been different from that point on.
Yeah, but I'm kind of glad I didn't win the lottery.
There's a different version of you in another reality that's uber rich now.
You know, I doubt, because how old was I then? I was probably in my late teens or early 20s
Yeah,
when
you
this
probably would have
happened.
lost it all by now.
And I don't think young me would have been very responsible with the money.
Right.
And I think my life would have unfolded in a way that would have made me a very different person today. So
Interesting take, yeah.
now I'm glad I didn't win the lottery.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's a healthy outlook.
I mean,
I'm not sure I would be able
at the
to get there.
time, I was choked.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine. Yeah, but anyway, I feel like I've definitely had I think precognitive dreams before in the past. Nothing huge, but it just like you, I tend to remember my dreams. They stick with me. A lot of the time, and I've definitely had moments where I'm not even thinking about it, going through my day, and all of a sudden I'll realize, like, wait a minute, this is exactly what I dreamed about last night. You know, it's never been useful, but maybe a dream journal will help with that. You know, maybe putting a stronger focus on what's going on in my dream life will inform me. Even earlier this week, I had a dream. It was very nebulous. I don't even remember what the rest of it, but I just woke up remembering this instant coffee tin that mom used to get. You know, it was this blue tin, and it was like a French vanilla flavor. And I don't know why that's important. I think it was purely just because it reminded me of mom in some way. And the next day, I was at work and she called me. And mom usually doesn't call. She'll usually, like, she will check in once in a while via text message. Yeah. And I always get a little worried when I see the phone, mom's name on the phone ringing, because I think, oh no, something's happened.
Yeah.
You know, something bad has happened and someone's hurt or something like that.
Yeah.
But no, she just decided to call instead of text and wanted to catch up and see if we'd have dinner this weekend or whatever. And I mentioned to her, I was like, hey, do you remember this coffee tin of this instant coffee she used to buy? And she's like, oh yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's this. And maybe that's pure random coincidence nonsense. Maybe there's nothing to that. But maybe that stuck out to me in the dream because on some level, I was making mental contact or perceiving what was going to happen the next day.
Yeah, and she called you the next day.
Yeah. And I don't know. That's not exactly an earth-shattering experience. The flooding thing is more interesting.
There's symbols there that connect to what happened the next day. And, you know, I think a dream journal is a good practice if you've got the discipline to get up in the morning and start writing in a journal. I certainly don't.
It is a bit of a pain because, I value being unconscious. I like sleep.
But, I mean... I mean, I have
to get up and run to work, it's not my favorite thing to...
But I say I remember my dreams quite clearly, and I do, for a little bit,
yeah,
anyway.
Like a couple minutes.
But yeah. I mean, minutes to hours, but that memory fades pretty quickly, unless it's usually with me, a really terrible dream, something that really sticks with you, because you'll make a conscious effort to remember it. You'll be thinking about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'll move from being a short-term memory to a long-term memory. But, you know, most of the time, those memories of dreams, you remember them, but it fades.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you could probably get some interesting... You could probably pull a lot of interesting stuff if you had a journal like that to draw on, to just look back through.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's it for me. I think that's my segment.
Oh, I have to go now.
Yeah. Now you have to go. I mean, we can take a break if you like. And we're actually at a decent length of time. So, I mean, we could take a break or, I mean, we could save your content for next week.
No, I'd really like to get into
it. You want to get into it? Okay.
I'm just a little... I was saying before we started, I'm a little nervous about presenting this subject matter coherently.
And well, it sounds like it's very incoherent subject matter.
And it's something, you know, I've been very into for a long time, but I don't feel like I'm the most qualified person to convey it to an audience, but I'll do my best.
Okay. I have faith in you.
So, just a little backstory on how I feel free to ask lots of questions and interrupt, because I'm not as good at monologuing as you are.
I don't know why you think I'm good at that. I don't know if you could tell,
well,
but I was reaching out to you a lot.
You're far better than me. You're far better than me. You've obviously, it's like you've had some experience in acting or something like that. Anyway, how I landed on this topic, because your original idea was we would come into this totally blind.
Yes.
You would pick a topic. I would pick a topic. We would have no knowledge of each other's topics we had to discuss. And it would be a surprise. We'd do live as we recorded the show. And I kind of grudgingly agreed to this.
Like, yeah.
I don't know, but I guess we could give it a try. And then... I think it was Monday or Tuesday, I texted you and I said, you know, you should just tell me what you're going to talk about, because I'm having a rough time here. I've got like a list of four or five things I could talk about. And I keep going back and forth on because I'm afraid we're either going to choose the same thing to talk about, which would be really awkward.
I don't think so.
Or I'm going to choose something that is so far removed from what you want to talk about that the whole thing will feel very disjointed.
I think that's great.
So
two random topics that are not connected at all, or if they just accidentally align, that's, you know, that works too, right?
But you told me that you wanted to talk about a book you had read about out-of-body experiences recently, and I thought, okay, that's perfect. I've got something that'll tie into this on so many levels. So what I want to talk about is I want to talk about the science fiction author Philip K. Dick.
Excellent.
Are you familiar with this man?
I am, not in great detail, but I know some of his works. I know, like, Scanner Darkly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I know he's very much, what is it? Is the phrase Doors of Perception? Is that him?
Doors of Perception? I don't believe so. No? Or maybe. There's a lot of Philip K. Dick, his work, that I don't know, actually.
Yeah.
And just because there's so much of it.
Yeah.
And if you're not familiar with Philip K. Dick, you're probably familiar with his work without even knowing it.
Yeah. And I feel like that's me, you know.
So the guy published in his life 44 novels.
Wow. Okay.
122 short stories, been adapted into movies such as, got a short list here, Blade Runner.
Oh.
Total Recall, Minority Report.
Oh, yeah.
A Scanner Darkly.
Yeah.
Most recently, the show, I believe it's on Amazon, The Man in the High Castle.
Oh, yeah.
That's
Philip
K. Dick as well. He's often cited as an inspiration, not a direct adaptation, but an inspiration for the script of The Matrix.
Right.
So he's prolific.
Yeah.
The reason why I wanted to talk about him... is Philip K. Dick very famously had a very interesting paranormal experience.
Okay.
In the 70s. And he developed sort of an obsession with it, and it very much consumed the final decade of his life.
Oh, interesting.
And I brought a book with me today. I was showing you just before we started. It's a very thick book. It's called The Exegesis. And it was not published while he was alive. Basically, the book is...
Sorry, what's it called?
The Exegesis.
Say it again?
Exegesis.
What's that mean?
It's, you know, I don't know what that word means.
I was really just trying to get you to flub the word, like, so I wouldn't feel bad about my own.
But
yeah, go ahead.
You know, it's... This book was published after he died, and it's not something you can read in... Pick up and read. It doesn't have any through line or any coherent narrative thread. It's basically a collection of his personal papers, his journal entries, his essays he's written, his letters, basically his mad ramblings in the final decade of his life as he was trying to make sense of this paranormal experience he had.
Right.
So just a little backstory on Philip K. Dick. Born in 1928, one of two twins. He had a twin sister named Jane Charlotte. Both of them were born 6 weeks prematurely.
Okay.
His twin sister, Jane, died after 6 weeks. So this becomes very significant in his life because he felt like... And it definitely influenced his work in many ways because he always carried a sense of guilt with him over that. You know, his mom even told him that, you know, Philip and Jane, Philip was always hungrier. Philip always was given more milk.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, Jane eventually died. I mean, this was
like survivor guilt.
Yeah. And this was in the 1920s, and these were both very sickly children, and this family was impoverished.
Yeah.
So it was something that happened. And actually, when Jane was buried, the headstone on her grave actually had both names on it. Because Philip K. Dick wasn't expected to live very long either.
Wow. Yeah.
So, okay. You know, throughout his life, whenever he went to visit his sister's grave, he was seeing his headstone.
Right.
Right next to hers.
Yeah.
He was visiting his own grave too.
Yeah, that'd mess you up a little. Yeah.
So, just, I say this just as some background on things that kind of influenced this man's personality.
Mm-hmm.
His parents divorced when he was 5 years old, which was very hard on him. He was born in Chicago. He moved with his mom to San Francisco. So, obviously, kind of a chaotic upbringing.
Yeah.
He became kind of a depressed and anxious child, but he kind of found his escapism in books, mostly science fiction books. He was a big fan of sci-fi magazines. He was a big fan of Ursula K. Le Guin. He eventually started studying at UC Berkeley. He did not declare a major, but he studied a lot of different things: history, theology, philosophy, psychology, zoology. He eventually dropped out due to his anxiety issues.
Right.
But decided he wanted to become a writer. That's what he wanted to do. Published his first short story in 1951 when he was 22. By 1962, just 11 years later, he won the Hugo Award for the novel The Man in the High Castle. So he's starting to become recognized. He wanted to be kind of a serious literary author, but he only really was taken seriously in the realm of science fiction,
which at the time was not considered real literature.
Yeah. And it also didn't pay very well.
Right, yeah.
We think of Philip K. Dick now. He's this very prolific author.
It's a big name that everyone knows, household name.
He very much lived in poverty his entire life. He had a very chaotic personal life. I just spoke about how prolific an author he was. 40-some books he published. Sci-fi didn't pay that well. He had to churn out a lot of work.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if it doesn't pay very well, you got to balance it out with quantity, right?
And to maintain this sort of pace of his working life, he did develop an addiction to amphetamines.
Right, yeah.
He would basically just write for days at a time without sleeping until he finally crashed. And this definitely took his toll on his mental health.
I can imagine,
yeah. Took its toll on his relationships. He was married 5 times.
Wow.
So he had trouble maintaining relationships.
But he was also able to find a wife 5 times.
True.
Glass half full.
He was probably a very charming man at the same time. If you look at his work, there's a few common themes in his work. Dystopia.
Yeah.
He's got this theme of dual personalities in a lot of his work. You remember A Scanner Darkly.
Yeah.
And he just, the overarching theme in all of his books is that the world is not quite what it seems. There's usually some big reveal in every one of his stories that of a false reality.
Right. Wow.
Anyway, this brings me to the paranormal experience he had.
Yeah, I was curious at the start. You didn't. So
yeah, I kind of wanted to just give a little bit of preamble on the man.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So his paranormal experience, which very much consumed the rest of his life, it happened on February 20th. 1974.
Oh.
Philip K. Dick was at his home recovering from dental surgery. He had just had his wisdom teeth extracted.
Mm.
And he was waiting on a delivery from the pharmacy. They were going to drop off his painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
So this delivery woman from the pharmacy comes to his door. And Philip K. Dick talks about this in his later writings. He was immediately struck by how beautiful this young woman was that was dropping off his painkillers. And she was wearing a gold necklace. And
did she end up marrying him?
No. He never saw this woman again.
Okay.
Never saw this woman again.
Sorry to interrupt. Sorry.
But she was wearing a gold necklace. And on the necklace was it's a symbol that's called a ichthys or a Pisces.
Yeah.
It's like a fish symbol. And he kind of became fascinated with this necklace. And he asked her, what's this? What's that necklace? What does it mean? And she kind of looks at it and is like, oh, someone gave this to me, but it's a symbol that was used by the early Christians.
Yeah.
You know, the fish symbol, you know, refers to Christ the fisherman.
Yeah.
He said at that moment, the sunlight kind of caught this necklace and reflected a beam of light into his eyes.
Oh, yeah.
He describes it as a pink laser beam.
Wow.
And he said at that moment, he felt like information was being downloaded into his mind.
So just a glint of light from the necklace, and he jumped into an ecstatic experience of something.
Yeah, he felt like all this information was being downloaded into his mind. He describes it as a moment of a loss of forgetfulness. He said for a moment, all these things he'd been writing about all these years about reality being false. He said just for a moment, he felt that false reality kind of fall away.
Wow.
And he describes it as, he lived in an irrational world, and just for a moment, a rational mind invaded his and shared consciousness with his.
Wow, that's a really interesting way of describing it. But yeah, that sounds really cool.
And he says for the next 2 months, his mind was shared with another entity.
Oh, here we go.
So
he's picked up a hitchhiker of some kind.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he eventually starts referring to this entity as VALIS.
Okay.
Which is an acronym for Vast Active Living Intelligence System.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, one of the things that VALIS showed him was he kept having hallucinations during this period where his everyday life as Philip K. Dick, the science fiction author, would fall away, and he was back in ancient Rome, and his name was Thomas, and he was one of the early Christians, but he had to keep it secret because the Christians were being persecuted. And he kept shifting back and forth between living his life as this science fiction author in the 70s and living as Thomas in ancient Roman times. And he began feeling like he was having this dual existence.
Right.
And he wasn't sure anymore which existence was the real world, his life as Thomas or his life as Philip K. Dick, the author. Ooh. And, you know, I spoke earlier that Philip K. Dick, he studied philosophy and theology in school. During this period, he became very almost obsessed with Gnosticism.
Okay.
Gnosticism, I've got a whole page of notes on Gnosticism here. It was basically an early form of Christianity.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of flavors of Christianity these days. A lot of them stemmed from the Catholic Church. The Catholic Christianity went through, I guess, a reformation in the Middle Ages. It split into all these different kinds of Protestantism.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in the first century, there were other kind of strains of Christianity. The one that kind of emerged as the dominant form of Christianity we know today was the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were other strains of early Christianity. Gnosticism was one of them.
All right.
Considered heretical back in the day. But the reason Philip K. Dick became obsessed with Gnosticism was Gnostics believed that the material world was false. The material world was an illusion.
Right. Yeah.
And that the kind of God of the Abrahamic texts, Judaism, Christianity, Islam.
Yeah.
That's the God you'd call Yahweh.
Okay. Yep.
Gnosticism believes that Yahweh is actually a false God. He's a mad god that rules over a dead, broken world.
Okay.
That is illusory.
Sounds like a fun guy.
Which, This idea strikes me as almost kind of Lovecraftian cosmic horror, actually. But anyway, this false god is actually kind of a lesser deity and is hiding the true nature of the universe from us. And, you know, modern Christianity believes that the path to enlightenment kind of... the path to enlightenment is through faith and through a personal relationship with Jesus.
Yeah.
Gnostics believe that the path to enlightenment is intuition and the revealing of hidden esoteric knowledge that will let you transcend this world of illusions, this reality of illusions we live in.
So based on the conversation we just had, like, I've been very much engaged in a Gnostic practice the past week.
Yes.
Basically what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Especially when you were saying, you know, it's almost like you're not leaving your body.
Yeah.
You're just expanding your consciousness into this realm above our material world.
Yeah.
Which is...
It's very much in line with that philosophy of Gnosticism. Okay, cool.
But anyway... aside from kind of wavering back and forth in time between 1970s USA
and so he's ancient Rome, jumping back and forth between these two lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as this was happening, he felt like he was sharing his consciousness with this entity known as Valis.
Okay. So he's got... So he's got a whole other personality as well. So he's really two people, but then there's also this third entity that's in his brain speaking to him.
Yes.
Okay. Wow, he's got a lot going on.
he's got a lot going on. Now he speaks about this at great length in interviews. He says it took over my thoughts and my actions. It was very practical. It immediately fired my agent. It fired my editor. It fired my publisher. It was very practical. It decided the carpet hadn't been vacuumed recently enough. It decided I should stop drinking wine and switch to beer instead. It did make elementary mistakes, like calling my dog he and the cat she, when the dog was a she and the cat was a he. Kept referring to his wife as ma'am. It would lapse into speaking Greek when it got more contemplative, something that to Philip K. Dick didn't even sound like language, but his wife recognized as Greek, having herself studied Greek. It had a very firm grasp of business matters. It set about remargining my typewriters. And he said, I began thinking it might be the spirit of my friend Jim Pike back from the dead. He'd returned to me like his son had returned to him. Just a little aside on Jim Pike, the Jim Pike he's referring to. Jim Pike, he's a controversial character in his own right.
Okay, I'm not familiar.
He was an Episcopal bishop. He's very well known. He was considered heretical by the church because... For a few reasons, and this was back in the 50s and 60s, he was an advocate for desegregation in the church.
Okay.
And he was an advocate for ordaining women in the church.
Oh, okay. So very progressive for his time.
Yeah. And he also got into a bit of trouble with the church because he became very interested by the occult and spirituality. Especially after the death of his son, this event Philip K. Dick is referencing his son coming back to him. He performed a séance to where he claims he was able to speak with his dead son.
Right.
So someone who was he was a bishop in the church, but eventually they decided it's a bit of a heretic too. So anyway, moving on.
Well, just to, if we can rewind 2 seconds to your description about Philip K. Dick's account of all these things this other entity made him do, and just as you were kind of going through that list, it occurred to me that this is starting to sound a lot like multiple personality disorder.
A little bit, yeah. And, oh, just wait, it gets stranger.
Okay, all right.
Continue. It gets stranger. He said, my wife was very impressed because of the pressure it put on people in my business. Money started flowing in. It immediately set about dictating letters to Congress regarding what was happening in the 70s while this was happening, the Watergate scandal that's mm-hmm. happening. According to Philip K. Dick, this entity dictated several letters to the Congressional Committee, which was investigating the ongoing activities of then President Richard Nixon. It wrote a letter to the Roman Catholic Church declaring that a miracle had occurred.
It strikes me as convenient that he's got this other entity to blame for all the, for speaking to his wife in a not nice way of firing his agent. And, it's a little convenient.
Yeah.
It's a little convenient.
So this entity also told him that Philip K. Dick, he had an infant son at the time. It told him that his infant son had an undetectable birth defect, which was could kill him at any moment. So Philip K. Dick and his wife, they take their son to the doctor and have all sorts of tests run and discover this is actually true.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And he does have something wrong that needs to be corrected that could kill him at any time. So Philip K. Dick said, after this entity had been with me for several months, it had calmed me, healed my son.
What did it heal him of?
His belief in the false reality that is the real world. After all this, the entity told him that the entity, he said, showed him a beautiful garden that he could walk through.
Okay.
And it said to him, I'm going to leave you now, but when you're an old man and it's time for you to die, I'll return and I'll bring you back here. And he said he found that remarkably calming.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound so bad.
But it also said to him, I've always been with you. I've been with you your entire life. And basically that it had always been influencing him in some way.
Like a spirit guide or a demon.
Yeah, yeah. And he said he got the sense that this entity was basically all-knowing and existed outside of time. Now you think of the things this entity supposedly showed him, that reality was false and it had always been sharing his mind. The very same themes are constantly coming up in books he'd written. Themes of a false reality.
That sounds a lot like a daemon. Have you heard of the daemon? Are you familiar with this?
Daemon.
It's if I'm expressing this or recalling this correctly, I believe the daemon, it sounds like demon, but it's different. It's basically referring to the higher self. So the analogy, a daemon could have multiple lower selves that it influences. So think about the analogy I like is of a video game. So if Super Mario is you, the daemon would be the guy holding the controller, right?
Okay.
And that he could influence your life, right? But it's basically the higher order consciousness that you are. Mm-hmm. And that when you stop existing, that daemon still exists. And he can, he could switch game cartridges and play Tomb Raider. And now he's the daemon of Lara Croft or whatever else, right? And so,
that's a very Gnostic sounding belief.
Yeah. But it sounds like that's what this entity is expressing to Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
That I've been with you your whole life. The reality you live in is false, right? And that there's a larger existence and I've been guiding you through your life. It sounds very much like that same concept.
Yeah, exactly. But just wait, it gets okay. weirder.
All right.
So
rabbit hole gets deeper.
So this is kind of why Philip K. Dick kind of becomes obsessed with this idea for the rest of his life, because after this, and again, you know, we just talked about two things. This entity has supposedly always been with him,
mm-hmm.
and Philip K. Dick gets the sense it's somehow all-knowing and exists outside of time in some way. So after this entity leaves him, strange things start occurring in Philip K. Dick's life that give him pause. Because, again, the guy's been writing his whole life. He's published all these books. He starts having weird moments of deja vu.
Okay.
Where he's just having a conversation with someone or just going about some mundane activity in his life. And he'll start feeling like, I've done this before. This is really familiar. What was that? And he starts rereading his old manuscripts. And events that are happening in his life are scenes from his old novels.
Oh, cool. Right, yeah.
So there's this... He was at a gas station. He was at a gas station, you know... And he started talking to this other customer at the gas station.
Yeah.
And they get into this really deep conversation. And he has this feeling that this feeling of deja vu, like this has happened before.
Yeah.
And again, he goes back and he rereads through his old manuscripts. And this, the exact same conversation he just had with this guy appears in a chapter of his novel, Flow My Tears, the policeman said.
Wow.
The exact same conversation happens between two characters in that book in a gas station. And
are you familiar? I guess this is something that's, he's not unique in this, that authors have reported that things that they write about end up kind of manifesting in the real world. Like, have you heard those stories? There's a famous one about the Titanic, where there was a book, that preceded...
Futility. The book was called Futility.
Right, yeah. Where it's basically the exact events of what happened to the real-life Titanic. Yeah. But it was in a novel that was written a decade prior.
Yeah, and the ship in the book was called the Titan.
Yeah.
And it was destroyed on its maiden voyage. It sunk after hitting an iceberg.
And it's not the same phenomena is not restricted to literature as well. Like a lot of artists, musicians, like Paul McCartney's famous for saying that, you know, the song Yesterday came to him in a dream. You know, and he's not the only one that has an account like that, where I think a lot of creative people will express that they feel like the ideas don't always come from them. It's almost like they're channeling them from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Rather than creating it internally. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe that's an expression. The creative act itself maybe is an aspect of how we connect to these morphic fields or this collective subconscious and draw upon it.
Yeah.
And maybe people that are creative and engage in creative activities just have that they're a little bit closer to that connection and kind of can download from that space and achieve like a gnosis. Maybe that's a source of creativity.
The Gnostics had a word for that.
Is it gnosis?
Gnosis is one of the words, but not what I was getting at. The Gnostics have kind of a word for kind of the divine spark that exists within all humans. Every human has a fragment of this divine spark in them, and that word is logos.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, when you're accessing those things, when you feel like your information is being downloaded from somewhere else, you're accessing the logos. But there's a quote here I want to read from Philip K. Dick, and this should sound familiar. This should sound very familiar. We are living in a computer programmed reality. The only clue we have is when some variable is changed and some alteration occurs. We have the overwhelming impression we are reliving the present. Deja vu.
Yeah, that's Matrix.
Where have you heard that before?
Yeah, it's the Matrix.
The Matrix. Anyway, Philip K. Dick, he died about 10 years after this experience. He had a series of strokes.
Wow.
Probably brought on by his decades of
drug use,
addiction to amphetamines, and he was actually buried next to his sister in that grave that he had his entire life. But in the 10 intervening years between this experience and his death, he wrote very frantically. And what was compiled out of many of those, I mean, he did write a handful of other books. He wrote Valis, which is basically a fictionalized account of this experience he had.
Yeah.
He wrote a couple of other books. He died before he could finish his final novel, which I believe was going to be called The Owl in Daylight. Nice reference to Moloch in the Grove there.
Yeah.
Would have loved to read that. But mostly he was writing very frantically, trying to make sense of this experience, later compiled into this book I have with me, The Exegesis, which is not an easy read.
Yeah.
it's not and, you know, even in writing it, he wavers back and forth between what was this experience? Was this God? Was this aliens? Was this some government program trying to mess with me? Am I just losing my mind?
Yeah.
He doubts himself a lot. And you don't often hear people who are actually losing their minds question their own sanity.
Yeah.
Which gives him some credence, but it's very disjointed and rambly, but there is this overarching tone of urgency to it. Almost like he could feel like his time was winding down.
Right.
And he needed to make sense of all this. But some of the things he talks about is how he's got this, he's constantly referencing what he calls the Black Iron Prison,
okay,
which is the false world that we've been led to believe is the real world.
Prison planet.
Yeah. And occasionally little bits and pieces of information from the real reality kind of filter through or intrude upon this illusion of a world we live in.
All right.
And that's why we see UFOs or see cryptids. These are little bits of information filtering down from the real world.
Right. Cool.
Yeah, it just seemed like a very relevant thing to talk about, especially now. There's so much talk now about simulation theory.
Yeah.
Is the world we live in the real world, or, as Elon Musk likes to say, base reality?
Yeah.
Probably not. All a lot of very Gnostic ideas.
Wow.
And, you know, I know I didn't get too much into, like, Philip K. Dick's actual bibliography, but he talks, you read some of his books and you almost feel like we're living right now in one of Philip K. Dick's dystopian novels.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote a book called The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. Awesome title, by the way. Palmer Eldritch, he's a very Donald Trump-like figure in this book.
Okay.
And he's got kind of a sidekick slash business partner in this book who's very much an Elon Musk like figure. There's a lot of parallels there.
Dare I ask, how does that book end?
Not very well for Palmer Eldritch, actually.
Oh, no?
A Scanner Darkly, which Philip K. Dick describes as a fictionalized autobiography. So watch that movie. Watch that movie with Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, I'll have to revisit it to see. It's been years since I've seen it, but that's an interesting way of describing it. I'll have to take a second look at that.
You know, and
what I remember most is just the kind of dystopian aspect of that movie, of being like in a total surveillance state, where basically you have to wear a mask that randomizes your appearance to have any kind of anonymity whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. So the first novel I ever read by Philip K. Dick, it was one called Ubik.
Yeah.
And there's this really, really interesting concept in this book called Half-Life. And what's happening in the society presented in this book is when people die or are approaching death, they're kind of put into a cryogenic suspended animation.
Okay.
And they're plugged into a computer, and they can keep on living in virtual reality.
Mm.
And their living relatives can come visit this facility called the Cold Pack.
Right.
And they can actually go into like a little telephone booth, and they can talk to their loved ones who are living in this virtual reality.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I read something like that now, and it's funny. They're talking about doing things like that.
Yeah.
Now,
also, did you play Fallout 3?
No.
I think there's like a stage, and there's a little storyline in Fallout 3 that's exactly that. Because, you know, everyone knows Fallout now because of the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So there's these vaults, and one of the vaults you stumble into, everybody's still frozen in their pods. I think it's like you're trying to find your father, and your father is apparently in this facility, and you have to upload yourself, and they're all living in this simulation in the Fallout shelter. Right. And they're in this very kind of Stepford Wives 1950s kind of fantasy world, right? But there's one person, the only person who's aware of the fact that this is a fantasy world. Everyone else is just embodying the character that they've been given in this world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to try and basically negotiate with this mad god in order to break everyone out of this little fantasy world. And it's a whole plot line. And I think it's Fallout 3. It might be Fallout 4. I can't remember. I think it's Fallout 3. But anyway, it's probably what inspired that storyline in Fallout. Was probably this story by Philip K. Dick.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, there's a lot more I could talk about with Philip K. Dick, and so many other things that this experience of his ties into. But I think that's the best coherent introduction I could give to this subject matter.
Is there a chapter two? Do you need to do like a follow-up? Do we have to have a follow-up?
I think someday we could do a follow-up of this. It's you've seen this book. I got it right here.
Yeah, it's massive.
This is a phone book. This is not an easy thing to even scratch the surface of.
Okay, cool.
But definitely,
I did that. Yeah, no, I thought that dovetailed really well. Yeah, interesting stuff. Yeah, I did, like you said at the beginning of this, you know, you know the name Philip K. Dick, and you can probably connect it to a handful of works you're familiar with that are just very much still in popular culture. But I didn't know much about him as a person, and all that. So was really interesting.
So what do you think? Something to that experience of his, or is he?
Or is it just the drugs? His mind? Is it just the drugs?
Is he just lost his mind?
You know, hard to say. uh But no, and yeah, definitely when you're talking about, oh, he had this experience, which seems to validate, you know,
yeah.
Did he really have that conversation with the guy in the gas station? Or is that just, you know, a kind of mental fantasy that's induced by madness and drugs? Or, you know?
Yeah, we only have his word on it, but... some of this has been corroborated by his wife at the time.
Okay, yeah.
Saying, you know, during this 2 month period, he did lapse into
speaking Greek,
and he doesn't speak Greek when he has no knowledge of Greek.
Okay, and, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I would think it's probably a bit of both. Maybe it could be maybe it's multiple things. Maybe it's psychosis and chemical influences, and maybe those two things combine to actually give him access or an altered perspective.
It's not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, maybe it all feeds into each other, right? And then, yeah, maybe his connection to it. Maybe he doesn't have the healthiest connection to that expanded conscious viewpoint, because it's come out of drugs and psychosis.
Yeah.
And that distorts everything.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it come out in unhealthy ways. But does that mean the connection isn't real? I don't know. Because one thing that I do take away from books like this and other literature that does strive to... and I'm referring back to Graham Nichols' book. And there is other papers and literature out there that very much documents the reality of things like psi phenomenon and remote viewing. So in my mind, I would say it's certain that this phenomena exists. So maybe it doesn't matter so much how we connect to it. I mean, obviously you want to do it in positive ways and are ways that serve your life in a healthy way.
Yeah. I don't think Philip K. Dick did that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he wasn't accessing
something. Yeah, and that's we're now putting value judgments on how he lived his life. But, I believe in the rich tapestry of experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, maybe he really loves the way he lived his life. The ups and downs, you know? I don't know. Who am I to judge? But I mean, he's obviously left a legacy and a lot of thought-provoking work that, you know, is influencing people today.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to pick up some of his books.
Yeah,
they're he's published 44 of them, and they're not the longest reads. I mean, he published on average 2 or 3 books a year.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's fascinating stuff, and yeah, sometimes I kind of look at the world around us and I feel like we're living in one of his books.
We're in the Matrix.
So it's a very relevant time to be reading his work.
Hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Wow, look at that. This is like a full-on podcast episode. We're approaching 2 hours here.
Oh, new record.
Yeah, new record for sure. That was really good. No, I thought that was a really great conversation. I hope we actually have a recording of this because I've been watching the screen this whole time of this little weird phase shift going on. I mean, it sounded fine before, but yeah, hopefully an episode comes out this week.
Yeah. Hopefully we don't have to like try to remember all that stuff we just said tomorrow and record it again.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I guess we'll call it a wrap. Hey, okay? We'll call it a wrap and actually see if I can put this together. But yeah, thanks for joining us, everyone, for another week. This was episode 8. Oh, wow. We're getting up there.
Yeah.
Got quite a catalog developing. So yeah, that's really good. I think around episode 10, I'm going to get some hats made.
I think that logo would look great on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Or a hoodie.
I want a ball cap. I want like a embroidered baseball cap. That's what I want. A t-shirt would be easier though.
I'm not a hat guy.
Maybe we could start with t-shirts.
Yeah. I mean, you could.
I'll get you a T-shirt.
You could.
And I'll
you
get
could
a
do
hat.
Both. You know.
Anyway. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Anyway, that's a few episodes down the road. Let's actually get there first. But yeah, no, I'm really happy with how this is going. You know, I didn't know well, I started this, like mentioned way back in the first episode, that this was basically an audition tape to begin with, and it just spiraled into its own thing. But I'm really happy with it. I'm still enjoying it. I'm happy to see more and more audience joining us every week. So I'm really proud of what we're doing here. So, and thanks for everyone who's listening. And I guess we'll wrap it up there finally, and we'll see you next week for episode number 9. Have a good night.